This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
We change tech a little bit now, but focus on the big stories in recent times on our diary of the week. So we welcome Dr. Dinesh Balia. He's the director of the Vets Center for Journalism. Dinesh, good morning to you. Welcome to Power.
Hi, Maria. How are you doing?
I'm all good. All right, here's an interesting story. And I mean, things don't cease to amaze us in South Africa. After what we have heard at the Zondo Commission and after all these promises by government and politicians that they will crack down on crime, here's the Department of Home Affairs. We've got a chief financial officer, Gordon Hallambi. He's facing charges of misconduct relating to an irregular biometric tender worth more than 400 million rands that was awarded to EOH Mtombo 4 years ago. I'm just wondering, in terms of this psyche, I mean, that is what I'm saying. After what we have heard at the Zondo Commission, you will think that people will hold back or people will change their ways, but it seems as if it continues. Why is that, Dinesh?
I can't tell you why it continues, but this is a, you know, this is a 4-year-old investigation, and I can say that, you know, there's a lot more to come to light, I think. Unfortunately, a commission or two, or three, as our state is often prone to do, is not going to put an end to this. I think there's a culture of impunity that has set in that really needs a stronger arm from the top, as it were.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because also, you know, this tender thing where you have the agents of government participating in this particular case, for instance, CETA is involved, that is the State Information Technology Agency that is involved and so on. I've got a feeling that, you know, within government, there is still this lack of integration and cohesion. And I'm not sure whether it's done deliberately, but we keep seeing it, you know, manifest from time to time in terms of lack of coordination and people using that lack of coordination to do things that are not in order.
It seems to me that governance processes are absent in most of our government processes on a daily basis. And you've hit the nail on the head in that there's no cohesion, there's no communication. It seems like entities are doing their own things on their own. And when that happens, you have a lack of oversight. And this case in particular is a key example of how those, you know, the problems will creep in when you have that lack of oversight, when you have people who are not paying attention to what is the correct thing to do, what is the right procedure, what is the right process, and adherence to policy. You know, it's not to say that our government doesn't have policies in place. We have a very robust government system, and we have key policies and procedures that are established and have, you know, worked up until these kinds of situations happen.
Dinesh, help me out here. Because you have, for instance, a school of government, okay, where they're taking all these technocrats, these bureaucrats, including the politicians, you know, and you look at some of the curriculum in that school of government, issues of ethics, you know, issues of governance and so on. And by the way, that school of government, it's running through our tax money. You know, it's run and administered through our taxes. But it seems as if even with these interventions, I know also the Public Service Commission also tried to do issues and relating to issues of governance or whatever. But it seems as if the rot is just too deep. What else can be done? Are there no international best practices that we can borrow, you know, to bring this gravy train to a halt?
Yeah, it's deeply frustrating, and I can hear that frustration in your voice, and I think you echo the sentiments of most South Africans, actually, who are very frustrated with the state of things. You know, training is one part of the interventions that we can make, but really a lot of this comes down to personal morals and an ethical standpoint as an individual, where your boundaries are in terms of what you are willing and not willing to do. And I was, you know, just saying to someone this morning, it seems like right at the top, you know, the fish is rotting at its head, as it were. And so for us in this country, I really do think that we need a firmer commitment from our politicians, from our leaders, actually, not just politicians, from our leaders, to take a standpoint and say no more. And we will not tolerate this anymore. And we ourselves commit ourselves to transparent, ethical, and fair leadership.
Yeah, indeed. Let's just get into the continent now, in Africa. The conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region. And I mean, you know, for me, it was a moment of joy and pleasure, but obviously which was short-lived, because it was a moment of joy and pleasure to see that South Africa played a role in hosting the warring factions in Tigray here in Johannesburg, you know, to try, to mediate that. And I was saying to myself, by the way, this is what we were once known for throughout the world. After after the collapse of CODESA, we got into the multi-party talks, and then, you know, we averted a civil war. And the country was saying that South Africa have skilled negotiators, but things have completely gone south. But in terms of what we have done with Tigray, not that we should take the entire credit, but it's quite interesting that something positive came out of the mediation that was hosted by South Africa.
Absolutely. And I think it's an excellent example of Africans, you know, solving problems for themselves. Unfortunately, the Tigray conflict itself was spurred on by Africans themselves, so amongst the Ethiopian regional government or federal government and the Tigrayan regional government. But it is a huge positive and a plus to be able to say that we solved this and that we facilitated it in South Africa, and we now see a very positive outcome from it.
Yeah, so we see that the dominant party in the Tigray region has announced its nominee for president of the regional administration, and he went on to call for peace. To call for peace. So, can we be optimistic that now, with even, you know, the parties nominating their candidates, that ultimately the peaceful elections will take place in the Tigray region?
I'm very positive. I think that, you know, Ethiopia's approach to Eritrea in not too long ago, actually, and then finding a truce and moving forward on in that particular conflict is a good sign for what is yet to come in terms of Tigray. Tigray itself, you know, that it's simply trying to, I wouldn't say simply, it is trying to keep the status quo in place and not have too many changes on the government arrangement in Ethiopia. So I'm very positive that, you know, whatever movement we have forward will not see us go back to the last 2 years of serious atrocities across the board, that we will be able to deal with the famine situation, that people will get the humanitarian aid that they now need, that we now, because we now have a government that is coming into play.
Yeah. It's very interesting because some weeks back I was talking about the scramble for Africa, you know, because it's also interesting to see that the Secretary of State from the U.S., Mr. Antony Blinken, you know, also visited Tigray and so on. So I keep asking myself, why is the West and also Europe, for instance, the form of Russia and China, are taking so much interest in the continent, including in regions like Tigray, for instance?
I think stability on the continent is key for the global economy. You know, there are many countries on this continent which are considered emerging and growing markets, actually. And for many parts of Europe and the US, we need to understand that there are significant economic benefits from peace on the continent, but the ability to conduct trade on the continent. So Africa represents a new front, as it were, for the global economy. So it's not just, I think, a very it is a self-serving move, let me say, on many of these on the part of many of these countries to ensure that there's peace and stability, because it ultimately has economic benefit, and unfortunately that's how politics goes.
Yeah. So Dinesh, as people who track these developments in the continent, for instance, we know that a couple of years back, even before the advent of COVID-19, resolutions that were taken by the African Union in a case of silencing the guns, because they were saying we are tired of these coup d'etats, we are tired of these armed conflicts, and they came up with a resolution or even a campaign or a strategy to say we need to silence the guns. Are we seeing progress as far as that is concerned within the continent?
You know, there are large parts of this continent that are media deserts, where we have no media coverage, sometimes deliberately by countries or states. So it's difficult to say at this point. I think certainly in certain conflicts we've seen a de-escalation. But it's difficult to say when you don't have as extensive media coverage as you do in a country like South Africa, for example.
Yes, indeed. I'm in a conversation with Dr. Dinesh Burley. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we continue our conversation on the news diary of the week. So the other interesting stories that we need to focus on, in particular, the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. There are some developments that she will unpack them for us.
Power Talk, this week's diary.
All right, indeed, the diary itself, interesting developments here, because we see South Africa together with the United Arab Emirates, they've offered to host the Inter-Parliamentary Union facilitated peace talks between Ukraine and Russia in an effort to find a negotiated settlement to end Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It sounds like a very ambitious thing to do, but very interesting that it is South Africa and the United Arab Emirates. Looking at your crystal ball, do you see this happening? Bringing Vladimir Putin and Zelensky across the table to talk peace, facilitated by South Africa and United Arab Emirates?
I'm an optimist. I think that certainly Zelensky would welcome any opportunity to sit in front of Putin. I'm not certain it will happen. But yeah, again, I'm an optimist.
Wow, it's very interesting. Do we know why, in particular, South Africa and UAE, who are championing this?
I'm not certain. I'm not certain here as to what it is. I don't want to speculate either.
Yeah, but I find it very fascinating, Dinesh, because there are developments now after the International Criminal Court declared Vladimir Putin, you know, a criminal and being accused of crimes against humanity, you know, war crimes, which is quite problematic. So I find it very curious because South Africa, we've taken over the chairmanship of BRICS and will be hosting BRICS countries here in Gauteng, for instance. Mm. So I find it curious that we'll Vladimir Putin come to South Africa because he's now declared, a criminal, and it's going to be expected of South Africa to act because we are signatories to the Roman Statute. How will that happen? I'm just asking this question in the context of what we've just spoken about. You say South Africa is trying to broker a peace between Ukraine and Russia, and we've got this development coming out of the ICC, and how will that happen? Do you think he will come through to South Africa? And if he lands in South Africa, what's going to happen with the South African government in terms of the alert that has been issued by the ICC?
Yeah, I think our memories are short and that we're forgetting that Omar al-Bashir, many years ago, there was an arrest warrant. The Sudanese president many years ago had visited South Africa when there was an arrest warrant out by the ICC. And managed to leave the country without that arrest warrant being executed by the country. I'm not sure if that's a precedent that has been set. I don't know if the South African government is going to change that and certainly act on it. But I doubt, from an international diplomacy perspective, that you would invite a guest and then arrest a guest. It seems rather problematic for me to be able to say to someone, you know, you can come to the country and we guarantee your safety, but then we're going to arrest you as you attempt to leave. So it puts South Africa in a bit of a conundrum. But I do know that they have said, via the official spokespeople, that they are aware of the legal expectations should he come to South Africa. I don't know what he makes of that situation. I guess at the end of the day, he would have to decide, and his people would have to decide whether it's worth his while traveling all the way to South Africa in terms of the security risk, but also the potential to be arrested.
Because the Omar al-Bashir incident, it sent our diplomatic relations into a tailspin. The Department of International Relations was on a back foot, and actually the entire country was on a back foot. And surely there are some lessons learned, but I wonder how this one is going to be managed. And I mean, it also comes in the wake of criticism by the US after South Africa agreed to do those military drills with China and Russia. So it's going to be very interesting how the South African government is going to deal with this one. Very, very interesting indeed. Yeah.
I think what's happening here is a question of South Africa just positioning itself in terms of who it feels a greater affinity to. And if you note, a couple of days ago, our Minister Naledi Pandor referred to Russia as friends, actually, in terms of the military drills, and said that most countries do military drills with their friends. And so I think she's more alluding to the BRICS Association than any other association. So I think South Africa is just positioning itself in the world spectrum to say this is where we stand. And as much as they've officially adopted a neutral stance in the Ukraine-Russia conflict, we are standing more on one side than we are on the other.
Okay. You know, the decision by politicians to name institutions, to name issues of value to the nations after, you know, stalwarts, people who have contributed immensely to a country. It might be through the arts, it might be through diplomacy, it might be through, you know, political contributions and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And which is a fine gesture, which is a fine thing to do. But it becomes messy and it becomes very disrespectful that people who are being honored through naming the institutions like hospital, for instance, Rahima Musa Mother and Child Hospital, even the name itself, you know, it just, it's such a warm, fantastic name. From the best run hospital to what we are seeing today, a chaotic hospital. It's dirty, it's unsafe, it's a danger to the patients and the workers. How do we reach such levels, Dinesh?
We reach such levels through people not caring anymore. And the more and more, you know, people who are in power look out for themselves, the more people on the ground are isolated from the basic services that they are entitled to as citizens of a country, or people living in a country. So we've reached a level with the Rahima Musa Hospital where, you know, it's rather symbolic of many of the hospitals across the country and the public service hospitals, which are meant to take care of people who need that healthcare, primary healthcare on a daily basis, people who cannot afford to go elsewhere, through our tax base, really. And so we reach those levels when people fail to care. And I think it's, you know, many of our conversations this morning speak back to the same point, that many of us have abandoned our moral, ethical duties in the jobs that we hold at the very highest levels of government. And we are failing to care for the people who need it most.
Yeah, indeed. As we conclude, we saw a very interesting ministry being announced by President Cyril Ramaphosa, the Ministry of Electricity, a former mayor of Tshwane, who was now serving as an executive in the president's office responsible for infrastructure investment, now being named the Minister of Electricity. And we're beginning to see things happening. So, and then Sputla Rabukopa has expressed confidence that they will deal with the issues because he says the plan is there. It just needs to be implemented and executed. Was it the right thing to do to appoint a Minister of Electricity?
So I find it very curious to appoint a Minister of Electricity when the role is largely operational. And, you know, a ministry really should operate at a very strategic level. So for me, this seemed like a portfolio within the ministry, actually. But if he needed the resources, if he needed the power behind him, excuse the pun, in order to execute his operational mandate, then let's see how far we get with this. I don't think in a bloated administrative system that we have at the public service level that we needed another ministry. But certainly, you know, Mr. Ramaphosa has a good sense of where his position lies and how it articulates with the various other ministries that were looking after electricity in the country previously.
Dr. Dinesh Balia, we thank you very much for joining us this morning. Much appreciated as we reflected on the news diary.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.